a North Korean whodunit today on the world. I'm Jeb Sharp. A chilling new detail in the murder of Kim Jong-nam, the half-brother of North Korea's leader, was poisoned with a nerve agent found in some chemical weapons.
You know, it sounds so futile. It sounds like something out of Henry VIII. But North Korea, in many ways, still does operate like a court in the era of Henry VIII. So if you cross the leader, you know, it's off with your head.
And later, the case of the unlikely roommates. Ben Stern is a 95-year-old Holocaust survivor living in California. And his roommate?
I'm from Germany. My father's parents, my grandparents, were Nazis. They were very active. They were really into the system.
Those stories ahead on The World. Glad you could be with us today. We start with a story that just gets stranger and stranger. I'm talking about the mysterious killing of the half-brother of North Korea's leader. The brother, Kim Jong-nam, died mysteriously after two women accosted him at the airport in Kuala Lumpur and wiped something on his face. He died on the way to the hospital. Now, it turns out that what they put on his face was a chemical weapon called VX. Charles Delfer is a former U.S. intelligence officer and weapons inspector. He calls VX the most sophisticated nerve agent ever developed.
What happens is that it shuts down the nervous system and causes death quite quickly in small amounts.
We did talk about VX in connection with Saddam Hussein in the 1980s. Remind us when it's been used.
Well, the Saddam regime developed VX. They used it in very, very limited ways. They never really weaponized it because it was a difficult thing to do. But certainly the knowledge for how to produce VX exists around the world. North Korea, it is no surprise that they would have VX or other advanced chemical agents because that's been the assessment for many years.
So North Korea was assessed to have it. Who else has had it over the years?
The United States, certainly, Russia, other countries that had nuclear weapons. It was developed in the early to mid-20th century when chemical weapons were a much more dominant part of defense inventories. But, you know, in the late 20th century and, you know, early the aughts, the Chemical Weapons Convention was having a lot of success in getting people off of that particular type of weapon. Most recently in Syria, the UN weapons inspectors were fairly successful in eliminating the Syrian inventories of nerve agent. They included the capacity to produce VX.
If the attack was orchestrated by the North Korean government, how worried should we be about North Korea and its use of this chemical weapon?
Well, it's not a big surprise. They have been assessed to have large, probably the third largest inventories on the planet of chemical munitions. So if you're in Seoul, you do have a lot to worry about because you're very close to the border with North Korea. You're only about 30 miles away, and North Korea can put VX into artillery rockets or artillery shells and launch them into downtown Seoul. So it makes the problem very complicated. The attack does seem to confirm that North Korea does have this advanced agent, and that's pretty interesting.
How is it possible that these alleged assailants could have done this attack and still be alive themselves if it's so deadly?
Well, that's the tricky part. For the North Koreans to use VX as an assassination tool is a tricky matter because you don't want the person who's using it to die in the process. And so normally there are two chemical elements which are only mixed together when you want to use the stuff. It's sort of like, you know, epoxy, where you take the two elements together and it doesn't start really becoming active until they're together. So clever people can figure out ways of doing that and to live to tell the tale.
How startled were you by this whole revelation?
Under the rubric of North Korea, there's very little, I think, that surprises most people. It's really interesting because the data that will be derived from just even these tiny samples will tell us a fair amount about what the North Koreans have done. There are various ways, for example, of making VX, and we'll learn a fair amount about the program if people take these chemicals apart and figure out what molecules are there and how they made it. They may even learn a little bit about how the North Koreans got the knowledge to create this agent. You know, they're just a strange country, and, you know, it's more evidence of why we should worry about their possession of not just these weapons, but nuclear weapons.
Former weapons inspector Charles Delfer, thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is a story with a lot of mystery. Even some of the things we think we know about it, we don't know for certain. Jean H. Lee is a global fellow at the Wilson Center, and she's been following the story from Seoul, South Korea.
It's pretty clear that this man was Kim Jong-nam, and he is the elder half-brother of the current leader of North Korea, Kim Jong-un. However, he was holding a passport under the name Kim Chol. Now, I do like to explain that that name is really the equivalent of John Smith. It is a very common name in North Korea. So not that surprising that he would be traveling under that pseudonym. Now, the interesting thing is the North Korean officials in Malaysia, they do have an embassy there, are denying that this is Kim Jong-nam. And there's absolutely no confirmation. No next of kin have turned up to confirm his identity, to provide a DNA or dental or medical records. So at this point, you know, the only ID that they have is Kim Chol, although for all intents and purposes, officials in South Korea are saying this was Kim Jong-nam and that this was an assassination that was most likely organized by the North Korean state.
What's it been like piecing this together, watching it unfold, this sort of piece by piece of information?
You know, it sounds so Machiavellian, or I should say it sounds so feudal. It sounds like something out of Henry VIII. But North Korea, in many ways, still does operate like a court in the era of Henry VIII. So if you cross the leader, you know, it's off with your head. So although we don't have any conclusive proof that this was the work of Kim Jong-un or his agents, we don't have that proof yet, it would be something that North Koreans would understand is part of the pattern of behavior among their leaders.
And kind of either way, do you see this as a sign of strength or a sign of weakness or neither? Or, you know, what's the crux of the moment for you?
So we could see this in a couple different ways. Kim Jong-un is a young man. He's got to rule over men who are quite a bit older than him, and he's got to maintain his hold over the people for quite some time if he's really going to remain in power until for decades to come. So you could see some of this as a sign that perhaps he hasn't consolidated his power. On the other hand, another way to look at this is he has now sent some pretty strong messages to his people that if they defy him, that he will be ruthless. He is not going to brook any kind of opposition. One of the important things to keep in mind is that in 2013, he had his own uncle executed. His uncle had been accused of plotting, exactly, overthrow the regime. And, you know, that was a chilling. I remember that, and it really, very chilling. This is what that told his people, particularly the elites who may have been grumbling or perhaps had some side deals that were taking away from his coffers. And the message that that sent was no one is safe, not even the uncle. Now he's going even one step farther and saying, no one, not even my brother, is safe. And I can get you no matter where you are in the world. You may have left the country, but I can still get a hold of you. Now, I should say all of that with the caveat, because, of course, this is still all very circumstantial. But hypothetically, it would be a very plausible scenario. And in the minds of the North Koreans, not so implausible, given the history, both recently with the killing of the uncle and throughout their traditional history.
Jean Lee, Global Fellow with the Wilson Center in Washington, currently in South Korea. Thanks so much, Jean.
Thank you so much.
We're going to hear now from a refugee who arrived in the U.S. 70 years ago. He's a Holocaust survivor from Poland, and today he lives in Berkeley, California, with an unlikely roommate. KQED's Sasha Koka brings us the story.
Ben Stern rolls up his sleeve to show me the one thing he needed to get into the U.S. as a refugee, his tattoo. The number 129592, still inked onto his 95-year-old skin.
I'm born in Warsaw, Poland. I am a Holocaust survivor of two ghettos, nine concentration camps, and two death marches.
Today, Stern can hardly see or hear, but he walks a mile and a half every day to visit his wife at a nursing facility.
He's a force for life. That's all I can say.
That's Stern's daughter, Charlene, who joins us for lunch. I ask him, what's the secret to longevity?
Being positive in life. optimistic, positive, go forward. Don't look back.
I thought you were going to tell her about your vodka.
I'll drink to that.
What are we having for dinner? What should we have?
Oh, yeah, we have salmon.
Also here with Stern is his roommate, Leah Heitfeld. They clean up the kitchen together.
We work together like a team, a good team.
An unusual team. Heitfeld's a 31-year-old student. She answered an ad that said this, 94-year-old, young, really smart, fiercely do-it-yourself active man who speaks six languages, looking for a housemate to share his apartment and help with grocery shopping.
And my professor wrote, Ben is the coolest, funniest, most handsome old dude I know.
And there's something else.
I'm from Germany. My father's parents, my grandparents, were Nazis. They were very active. They were really into the system.
But Heitfeld's parents were not. Now she's a grad student studying Holocaust and Jewish studies. But she says she's driven by her role in history.
What am I doing right now when what is happening in the world? Where am I contributing? Where am I standing up? Where am I raising my voice? And as long as I'm not doing anything, I will always stay a perpetrator in a way. I will stay someone who hasn't learned from history.
Stern says he was happy to meet her.
I'm open-minded to get along with people. I want to prove it that it can be done. Different ages, different religions.
And her name, Leah Heitfeld, sealed the deal.
My grandmother's name was Leah, and I carried her on my arms to the Warsaw Ghetto. And she passed away in the ghetto starvation.
These days, the roommates eat dinner and watch the news together. And they both share their fears about President Donald Trump's policies toward refugees. Stern says watching Syrians and Iranians being turned away at airports under Trump's travel ban made it hard for him to sleep.
My pains are from the past, but it brings me right back to that point in my life all over again. I learned a long time ago that history repeats itself.
He tells Heitfeld he's worried about how Trump is approaching civil rights.
There's a shadow in the sky, a tornado hanging, and we don't know where it's going to hit. We got to be alert, watchful, and responsive.
Heitfeld says life with her new roommate has been surprising, especially
how much I got out of the interaction with Ben, which gave me the idea to move on and to rise up and to do something, to become more proactive, but also very soothing and strong company of we will do this together.
Stern shares that hope.
I'm only 95 years old, but I must tell you that I am still full of hope. I'm hopeful we as Americans continue to live and enjoy the freedom that this country offers.
For The World, Sasha Coca, Berkeley, California.
This is The World. In London, Shakespeare's Globe Theatre is a world-famous tourist attraction with tens of thousands of visitors every year coming to watch some of the Bard's great works. But the Globe was only one of the many theatres that his plays were performed at, and Shakespeare himself was only one of many writers putting on drama at that time. Now a new project is aiming to rediscover some of those forgotten masterpieces. It's called Before Shakespeare. Our London reporter, Leo Hornack, has been finding out more. So what is this?
The idea behind this project, and it kind of grabbed me immediately, was that we know that Shakespeare is the greatest writer who's ever lived. But because he is so great, he has tended to obscure a cultural boom that actually happened just before him. Theatres opening, plays being written, actors being trained. And the really interesting thing about that to me, Jeb, was that without this boom having happened, you would never have had a Shakespeare. They were like the soil that allowed us to have Shakespeare. I spoke to one of the scholars behind the project. His name's Andy Kesson of Roehampton University. And he told me about one of the sites they've uncovered. They've started digging in to the remains of one of these forgotten theatres.
We have a really good sense of what you would have seen because there is a prop list that survives. That includes the City of Rome. Imagine seeing that at the back of the stage as you enter the playhouse. It contains a cloak for to go invisible, a cloak to make you invisible. They were clearly staging Harry Potter in the Rose Theatre in the 1590s. And the one that blows my mind the most is there was a naked suit, a suit to put on to make you look naked, made of taffeta. So you would put clothes on in order to be naked. I really love that idea.
So there you go, Jeb. You can hear there was a whole kind of culture that has got buried in these remains and in these forgotten theatres.
Am I right that you were at the site as well?
Yeah, it was fantastic, actually, Jeb. I got to visit with Andy the site of a theatre called The Curtain, which was one of these theatres that were part of this boom. In just a couple of decades, 10 theatres opened across London. So it was kind of this new form of entertainment. I mean, probably the best comparison is the way that cinemas boomed in the early 20th century. You know, all across the city, suddenly these new public places of entertainment appearing with new kinds of dramas being put on for the public within.
What's most striking about what these forgotten plays actually tell us about that time?
I was sort of brought up thinking that this classic era of drama is Shakespeare. What Andy in particular explained is that when you pull back the focus a bit and see these other plays, you see that some things we might think about that era are actually just about Shakespeare. And there's, in fact, for example, a much more subversive range of topics being covered in some of these forgotten plays and forgotten playwrights. Have a quick listen to what he told me.
We see plays which are more ready to center themselves around female protagonists, central female characters. We see plays which have as many women in them as men. And that's something which we don't see Shakespeare doing. The first five surviving plays from these playhouses are all named after central female characters. Shakespeare, in his 40-play career, never once names a play after a female character. We have Romeo and Juliet, and we have Antony and Cleopatra, where you get a woman's name after a man's name, but you never get a Shakespeare play named solely after a central female character. And yet the first five surviving plays from these playhouses all manage that feat because they are so interested in and intrigued by female identity.
So there you go, Jeb. There's far more in the ruins and foundations of London than just Shakespeare and his book of plays.
Apparently. What happened?
Well, I mean, hopefully people like Andy and the rest of the people behind the project are going to be performing some of these lost plays and trying to resurrect some of these theatres. So I think there's a lot more to come from this project.
The World's Leo Hornack in London. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Jeb.
And while we're talking about gender, women around the world often have to deal with criticism about their appearance. They're too old, too fat, and in some places too dark. Our partners at the BBC have made a documentary about the widespread phenomenon known as shadism or colorism, basically discrimination on the basis of skin tone, including here in the U.S. Here's an excerpt from the documentary from reporter Valley Fontaine. It starts with the voice of an academic, Yaba Blay.
People would say to me, oh, you're pretty for a dark-skinned girl, which is not a compliment at all, because it says that, you know, dark skin is not pretty, but here you stand as the exception.
Professor Yaba Blay's parents moved from Ghana to the Deep South, a place where the lines between dark and light were much more pronounced.
For me, growing up, born and raised in New Orleans, I was made to know that I was dark-skinned from very early on. It was a point of conversation always about just how dark I was. I remember having a very good friend in elementary school whose family was Creole. She was very, very light-skinned. And she had a birthday party, and I wasn't invited to it. And we were very close. And I remember asking her, you know, where's my invitation? How come I didn't get invited? And she said, well, you know, my mama said that you're too dark. So I think there definitely is a pain that comes with not only identifying as dark skin, but being seen as dark skin. And again, there's a long history of that.
The foundation of colorism was set by slavery. The mixed children of slave masters would often be given lighter duties. They would be the slaves likely to be chosen to work inside the house. Some even had access to privileges like reading and writing. Thus, a narrative was born.
The presumed Europeanness in them made them more human. For women, it made them more feminine, more beautiful, more less African.
All the race fellows crave high yellows. Gentlemen prefer them light.
Even after the abolition of slavery, the idea that lighter is better remained.
What did I do to be so black and blue?
The song, it was like, brown skin, you know I love your brown skin. And I was little, and I remember I was like, brown skin, you know I don't like this brown skin.
This is Savi from Memphis, Tennessee. She's a teenager and is much darker than her mother, Nikia, who has very light skin.
She was, Mom, I want to look like you. I don't look like you. I don't like my skin. My skin's not the same color as yours. So what I have to do is constantly show her magazines of darker-skinned women that are considered beautiful. Because, I want her to feel comfortable in her own skin. I want her to be able to feel like she's just as pretty on the outside as a light-skinned woman, as a white woman, as any other woman.
Brown skin, you know I love your brown.
It's important for me that we understand who the primary culprit is. The primary culprit is white supremacy.
Dr. Yeba Blay again.
We do ourselves a disservice by pointing the fingers at one another. That's easy. And so for me, if we recognize if I'm light-skinned, if I'm dark-skinned, if we both point the finger in the right direction, which is towards white supremacy, then we're closer to actually addressing it. We didn't do this, so we can't necessarily fix it all by ourselves.
Yaba Blay speaking there in that excerpt from Valley Fontaine's BBC World Service documentary about shadism. It's called Michelle Obama, Black Like Me. This is The World. I'm Jeb Sharp. A few months back, there were reports that teenagers in the town of Veles, Macedonia, were behind a lot of the fake news we were reading here in the U.S. This Macedonian reporter doesn't buy it.
Those teenagers from Veles hardly can speak English and hardly can read English.
So who were they working for? We'll hear more ahead on The World. I'm Jeb Sharp, and you're tuned to The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. First, it was fake news, then alternative facts. Remember that town in Macedonia where teenagers were making good money manufacturing and posting fake news stories during the election last year? We wanted to find out if that's still going on, so we called investigative reporter Sashka Svetkovska in the Macedonian capital, Skopje.
Absolutely, it's still going on and it's still very active. And just for the record, those websites that were probably influencing the presidential campaign in the United States are still active. Teenagers are involved. Fake news exists. And they're even redesigned so that they can maybe serve some other purposes like influencing the French elections and the German elections. But there is something that we should all ask. Are those teenagers really, really the ones who came up with this big idea that they can make money from Google Ads just by making news about the Trump and making fake news about his opponents? I don't really believe the story. I'm working like for 2 or 3 months and we are really digging deep. And we have analyzed all the content on all of their websites. And what I can say, and I can say that with huge confidence, is that no, those were not teenagers from Veles. Those teenagers from Veles hardly can speak English and hardly can read English. And our impression is that the content of those fake news websites has an editorial policy, like a serious editorial policy. They were publishing positive articles about Donald Trump, negative articles, not just about his opponent Hillary, but also about everybody who was attacking him or at least what his campaign was considering for attack, you know. And then there was this parallel process on all of these websites. They were just randomly publishing articles that were pro-Russia, pro-Putin, They were not articles that were in any correlation with the elections, but they were just really, really highly positive articles about the Russian president. We can say that this is the picture of the general policy of all these websites.
Sashka, so who do you think is behind the fake news?
I don't know. I think that they were hired by somebody, and I think that this was a carefully planned campaign. Since we are still in a process of investigating, and we are still digging and digging and digging, so far the only thing I can say is that we are strongly confident that those fake news websites, they have a client. They were ordered by somebody. I can make assumptions. You know, you can just go through the content very carefully, read all of them, see what they're publishing, and it's obvious. They have an editorial policy, a very strict one, a policy that obviously is serving somebody. We don't know who. We have our own guesses, absolutely, but we cannot share this with the public. We are waiting and we are
still investigating.
Yes, but they do have a client, and I do not believe that that client is United States-based client.
How do we citizens think about this, work on this, change this?
Well, what we have now in Europe, we have so many fake news websites. So we have everyday fake news like a girl was raped in Sweden, a granny was beaten and raped in a store in Germany by Syrian refugees. So we have a lot of fake news that are targeting the Syrian refugees, and they are ongoing on a daily basis. And what is happening now, it's very hard to convince people that those are lies, because people are consuming their news on the internet. You know, the audience is not tend to think like, oh, should I check the source of it? Oh, let's see who brought this, who owns this media. Nobody is thinking about that. What would people say is it was on the news, and the news is widely consumed on the internet nowadays. So it's very hard to fight this. What happened with the presidential elections, the fake news stuff and everything, it was kind of a good thing because it forced you guys in the United States to think about this. And it's a good thing that you think about this because somehow we can make a change. Maybe.
Sashka Svetkovska, I hope we'll be talking to you again soon, an investigative reporter based in the capital city of Skopje in Macedonia. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much and goodbye.
Fake news, alternative facts, dystopian realities. Welcome to 2017. Mary Kay Magstad of our podcast Whose Century Is It? Has been thinking about President Trump's attitude toward the truth and how governments through the ages have tried to destroy or hide knowledge and information. She joins me on the line from her home in San Francisco. Hi, Mary Kay.
Hey, Job.
So you begin this week's podcast with some great examples of how rulers and governments have tried to control information through the ages. Just remind us of a couple.
Right. Well, so if you want to go to Wikipedia and just look up book burning historical, you'll get about 170 examples of times when rulers in different ages decided that previous knowledge was really kind of annoying and a challenge to their rule. And this was true of China in 200 BC under Emperor Qin Shi Huangdi. It was true with the Spanish conquerors over the Aztecs and the Incas. It was, of course, true with the Nazis and with Pol Pot in Cambodia. It was true to some extent during the Cultural Revolution. And, of course, now we have a president in the United States who his administration talks about alternative facts and has tried to get rid of some government websites or contents that they would prefer not to have out there in the public.
Can you give us some examples, Mary Kay?
Well, here's one. And in fact, Rachel Maddow on MSNBC talked about this on her show in late 2016. Mike Pence, when he was first running for Congress, apparently had on his webpage the idea that instead of the government putting money into helping people who have AIDS, they should take that money and help people not be gay anymore. So that page was eventually taken down, but you can use something called the Wayback Machine, which is part of the Internet Archive, and go back and find websites from 2 years ago or 10 years ago, or versions of existing websites that just look different than pages that may have disappeared, that people may have wanted to have disappear. You can still find through the Wayback Machine.
And so you visit the Internet Archive. What's it like? What's it for?
Right. Well, what they're doing inside is digitizing books and also capturing video streams from television networks around the world. and putting that into the archive as well. So far, even though they only have about 140 people working at the archive, they digitize about 1,000 books a day. They've already digitized more than 2.5 million, and they're going for 10 million. They basically have this really lofty goal of making as much of human knowledge as possible universally available online.
And the guy behind this, Brewster Kahle, you know, he's just one of these forces, and he's so enthusiastic and so driven to do this. And I'd love you to play a little clip of him, especially where he explains how little of this knowledge we can actually access online, even though we think we have so much access to everything.
I think we really shot ourselves in the foot. We convinced people to turn to their screens, to the web, to answer questions. There it is. It's the Library of Congress on your desk. But it isn't. The Library of Congress isn't on your desk. You get some stuff in Wikipedia. You get some things from the Internet Archive or Google Books, but you get snippets. This isn't good enough. It's not a way to run a culture. I think what we saw out of the poll election cycle is people were just echoing around what it is they could find. And it just tended to be gossip and just junk.
So I love his drive and his commitment and his optimism, actually, that if you put knowledge in front of people, they will want to absorb it. And I think that's true of many people. In fact, 5 million people are using or accessing the Internet Archive every day right now. But I also think it's true that some other people really don't access information that's available to them, or don't know how to sift through information to recognize, you know, what's credible information and what's not. And I think that will be a challenge going forward, not just in the United States, but also in other parts of the world, as governments and others in power or others with power find ways to manipulate perceptions. And the Internet Archive is valuable both for being a repository of verifiable facts and knowledge and writing, also for being a repository of fake news and of propaganda, so that future historians and journalists and anyone who's interested can look and see, well, how were people being manipulated in the past, just as we now look back to propaganda from Stalin or Mao or the Nazis.
Mary Kay Magstad is the host and creator of the podcast Whose Century Is It? Thanks for telling us about the Internet Archive.
Thanks, Jeb.
You can find Mary Kay's podcast at PRI.org or on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. The International Criminal Court has a lot of critics in Africa. One complaint is that the court seems to target African governments. Right now, the ICC is reviewing about a dozen cases against African leaders, some involving systemic violence against women. South Africa wants to withdraw from the ICC. Burundi has already done so, and the African Union is urging other countries to leave as well. But if they do withdraw from the ICC, what does it mean for the victims seeking justice, especially women? The world's Jasmine Garst has the story as part of our Across Women's Lives project.
She made up her mind when she saw the baby. There's a sadness to Amal, but it isn't weakness. It's like a firm, solid melancholy. It's hard to imagine her running away from anything, but here's what happened. She was working as a school teacher when the government forces torched her village in the Darfur region of Sudan. She and the villagers made their way to a refugee camp. That, she says, is when she saw the baby, a girl no more than 5 days old, trying to feed off her mother, who was dead. So she picked that baby up and walked for 3 days to the camp, which is how she decided to become an activist for women and children. She started her own nonprofit organization. Amal says that of the women who came to her, many were victims of rape, some were pregnant, often suicidal.
It's a systematic targeting of women who are the bearers and the fabric of society.
Monica Feltz is the executive director of the International Justice Program, which assists victims of genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity. And she works with many victims of Sudan's civil war.
Commanders and those who are perpetrating the crimes, they know that women will be stigmatized if they're raped, if they bear children who are not of their same tribe, This is a very systematic approach by the government forces.
Amal says back in Darfur, when she would report rapes, the official response would be, look, this happens. Assault happens. And then it happened to her.
آخر مرة جيت أمريكا بأنه اتعرضت شغالة معلمة وبعد ما جيت كان جيت مؤتمر هنا.
She was detained, she was tortured, she was assaulted, and when it was over, she was able to make her way to the U.S. as a speaker at a conference. She stayed as a refugee. During that time, something completely unprecedented happened. The International Criminal Court issued an arrest warrant for Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir for crimes against humanity, including rape. It was the first time that the ICC had taken this kind of action against a sitting president. But al-Bashir never got arrested. A lot of people saw this as a sign of how ineffective the International Criminal Court was. At the time, Gambia released this announcement.
The ICC, despite being called the International Criminal Court, is in fact an international Caucasian court for the persecution and humiliation of people of color, especially Africans.
Gambia recently decided to stay in the ICC. But just a few weeks ago, the African Union announced it was backing a mass withdrawal from the court, citing the same argument. There are all these cases focusing on Africa. Meanwhile, the U.S. and China aren't even subjects to the court. I caught up with Luis Moreno Ocampo, the first chief prosecutor for the court. He brought charges against Sudanese President al-Bashir. He says African countries pulling out is a sign of how scared they are of the court.
Leaving the court is not because the court is inefficient. No, the court is the only efficient international institution we have to stop massive atrocities.
Ocampo says it's not the future of the court he's worried about. The court will survive. And maybe they don't get President al-Bashir arrested, but at least they're trying to get the truth out.
Africans, they need the ICC. Victims in Africa need the ICC. At least ICC helping to keep saying, okay, but Bashir commit genocide. You like to ignore, forget it, but Bashir commit genocide. So the truth is important.
Especially important to women, says Monica Feltz.
I mean, the domestic courts in Darfur are a joke.
At the end of the day, for scores of women in Africa, the International Criminal Court is the only place they can turn to.
I think it's very hard for many women to gain any sort of justice at the local level if there aren't mechanisms in place for it, which is where the ICC comes in.
Far away from Sudan, Amal has been watching it all unfold. She recently got her asylum status granted in the U.S., but she says she just wants to see justice in Sudan. And she asks, what good does an international court do if it can't even get a leader arrested? But she also says, whether it's the International Criminal Court or God, someone someday will bring justice to those who harmed her. For The World, Jasmine Garst, New York.
I'm Jeb Sharp, and this is The World. America is rife with conflicts these days, and very often outsiders are being blamed for causing them. Well, here's a story about an outsider who might actually be helping. This particular conflict involves ranchers, conservationists, and wolves in Washington state. Wolves are back in Washington for the first time in 80 years, and some of them are eating livestock. But one woman with an unusual background is working with ranchers to try to soften their feelings toward wolves. Here's Eilish O'Neill.
Bill Johnson and his seven border collies live in a log house that Johnson himself built in Washington's Tianaway Valley. It's just over the Cascade Mountains that divide rural eastern Washington from the more urban western part of the state. Johnson's been a cowboy here for about 16 years. When he started, there were no wolves around. But that changed about 5 years ago.
Sharon and I were coming out of the valley one night, and a deer ran across the road. And these three large German shepherds ran across after the deer. And I'm thinking, those aren't German shepherds, those are wolves. Those are wolves, can you believe it?
A month later, the return of wolves to the area really hit home.
The first animal I lost to a wolf was one of my dogs, a little border collie named Lance.
Johnson turns away from the mic and covers his eyes. Then he stands up and goes to the bathroom. When he comes back, his eyes are wet.
Sorry about that. The first animal I lost to a wolf was one of my working dogs, Lance. And Lance went off on his own, and by the time I realized he was gone, it was too late.
That night, Johnson saddled his horse and grabbed his gun.
I was going to kill every wolf in the Tanaway.
And he says a lot of ranchers out here in eastern Washington feel the same.
There are ranchers who operate on the premise that the only good wolf is a dead wolf. When the wolves first came here, their vision was that the wolf pack was going to run rampant through the Tanaway Valley and kill all the elk and all the deer and then start working on the horses and the llamas and the cattle. And eventually, they would start pulling children out of the sleeping bags at night.
Since 2008, Washington's wolf population has gone from zero to nearly 100, and those wolves have killed at least 27 cattle. The state has a policy of culling any pack that kills more than four cattle. It also offers to compensate ranchers for animals lost to wolves. But it turns out, ranchers don't much like that idea.
You know, compensation, someone comes in and you have to, like, write down and it's like you're begging for this money.
That's Carol Boghese. She's not a rancher, but she spent enough time with many of them to know how they feel. She's a researcher at the University of Washington in Seattle. And for the past 2 years, she's been talking about wolves with ranchers and cowboys, like Bill Johnson.
Okay, have a seat. I'm new to all this.
Today, Boghese is sitting across the table from Johnson in the checked flannel shirt she says she always wears to these interviews, to fit in.
Oh, look at that. Mine's kind of bland.
And she says she starts every interview in the same way. She tells the rancher,
I'm not even from Seattle, so I won't be telling you what to do.
Not from Seattle. It's a big icebreaker in these parts. To many folks in eastern Washington, Seattle represents the urban elite, people who like to pontificate about what others should do, but have no idea what life out here is really like. And Boghese is, indeed, not from Seattle.
I grew up in Uganda. My home was not quite in the city.
Her family had a small farm outside Uganda's capital, Kampala. So Boghese says she understands the rancher's perspective. Her family had problems with predators, too. Things like civet cats and monkeys that would eat her family's chickens, sheep, and goats.
For my parents, they were really pests.
It was her job to shoo the predators away. That was during the day. At night, the family hired someone to take more lethal action. Carol would sometimes find a dead predator in the morning.
It was heartbreaking. You don't want them to be eating, like, the lambs or baby goats or chickens and stuff. But then also finding, like, a dead civet cat felt sad.
Boghese says her family thought she'd outgrow her love of predators, but she didn't. After college in Uganda, she worked with crocodiles. Then she got a scholarship for grad school at the University of Washington. That's how she ended up here. Boghese studied a range of possible solutions to Washington's wolf conflict. The one she thinks would work best is a wolf-friendly meat certification program. Ranchers who do their best to minimize conflict would be able to sell their meat for a premium in places like, well, like Seattle. She thinks there's a couple of reasons it could work.
Partly because once a market incentive takes off, it pretty much is then regulated by the laws of economics, which ranchers really mostly like to work with. And it's also not a very novel thing in the West. You don't have to start from scratch.
Boghese recently won another scholarship. This one will help her study the idea from the consumer side to see how much people might be willing to pay for wolf-friendly meat. After that, she hopes to start a trial run of a wolf-friendly meat certification program. Cowboy Bill Johnson was skeptical of the idea at first, but his talks with Boghese helped him change his mind about living with wolves.
Once the anger and the grief, I guess you will, once that was gone, it was a natural process. I mean, you take somebody swimming in the ocean, there's a chance they're going to get eaten by a shark. The wolves came back. They've basically wandered back into their homeland. And so we're going to get along. We're going to make it work.
And if it does work, Carol Boghese says it may be partly because of her role as an outsider, a real outsider, not just from the other side of the mountains, but from the other side of the world.
Because what happened here is I have to listen more. I have to make sure I understand. And I think that's a great skill to have when you're going to be working with communities about wildlife or other natural resources which they may not think of as the most valuable thing.
And it's a skill that Boghese eventually hopes to bring back to Uganda, where she wants to work on preventing conflicts between people and elephants. For The World, Eilish O'Neill, Tianawe Valley, Washington.
Finally today, Brazil's bad economy has claimed its next victim, and it's Carnival. At least 70 cities across the country have had to cancel their traditional celebrations, just at a time when people really need them. You can read about that at PRI.org. Carnival may be muted this year, but Brazilian music sure isn't. Here's a new tune from the band Graviola. They're at the forefront of the alt-tropicalia movement in Brazil.
Rodando uma geral no seu mural, pescando aquela rara notícia que você não viu no jornal, com pinta de imparcial. Sim, você que diz saber sobre as mazelas do sistema capital, compartilhando denúncias, engajamento natural.
This song, Sem Sentido from Graviola, closes our show today. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Jeb Sharp. Our theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. Marco Werman is back in the host chair on Monday. Until then, have a great weekend.
Valeu a pena pesquisar os detalhes daquela política. Sob a ótica da antimídia, tem no post a informação. Recortar e copiar ideias, a nossa função pra depois.
PRI, Public Radio International.